Okay. Good to be with you. Looking forward to the week. Looking forward to all of the topics except mine. Yeah. This is, all right. Ken had asked me to speak on postmodernism last year, and I think this is an important series of lessons. These will not be sermons, but I hope it will be material that will help you think for your sermons. Friday will be more of a sermon, but there's going to be a lot of history and a lot of philosophy, but it's not just to explore those philosophies for their own sake. I hope what it is for us to know our own minds and for us to understand why we think the way we do. We are inevitably affected in our thought processes, in our worldviews, by the world that we live in. You know that a teenager thinks differently about communication than our grandparents did, than even us, but especially our grandparents, the instantaneousness of it all. They think differently about how to get information. Do you think we're affected in our attention spans, for instance, because of the world that we live in? We don't even have to speculate about those things. We know it. We know it, and even if we didn't know it, we can even calculate it. I mean, they're doing studies on the attention span and so forth and the decrease of that. So all of the work that we're going to do this week, it's not just so that you know more things. It's so that you know why we are where we are. Carl Truman, in his book, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, he starts the book by using the phrase, or bringing up the phrase, "I feel like a man trapped in a woman's body," or "I feel like a woman trapped in a man's body." And he starts by asking, how did we get to a place in our society where that feels like a normal thing for someone to say? And so he starts going back and trying to figure out how we got to here. That's not the only concern I have, but it is one of the concerns I have, right? How do we get to that place where people don't feel like that's just something someone in an insane asylum would say? This and many more, and particularly things that people say that are troublesome, not just out there in the world, not just in Hollywood, but in churches. How do our minds get so far in our thinking from the roots of God's Word? We're going to talk about things that you may feel like are above your head. It's not above your head. It is not out of your reach, but it may make you reach in order to grasp it. Everything that you have not studied is out of your reach until you reach for it. And so I think that's what happens sometimes when we're studying something we haven't studied before. We say, "Well, that's just over my head." Well, of course it's over your head, because you haven't gone and gotten that yet. But if you get it, then it will be within your wheelhouse. There are people, I preach to a congregation full of engineers, and they will say things like, "Oh, boy, that's above my pay." Nonsense. You worked on a satellite that takes pictures of the outer reaches of the universe. Don't tell me about things that are above your pay grade. It's just something you haven't studied yet. So don't cop out, right? Don't check out and just say, "Oh, well, I don't know anything about this stuff." It is not that you can't know it. Maybe there are things here you simply don't know yet. So our goal, one of my goals this week is to convince you that at least some of this is something you need to know about. It's like with parents and social media. An older generation sort of just goes, "I don't know about that. I stay away from all of that. I don't care about all of that." Well, I don't want parents to know social media so that they can get on it and use it all day. I want them to know about it because their kids are on it using it all day and are being affected by it. So you don't have a choice to just stay neutral and stay out of it. It is surrounding us. It is saturating us. It is affecting us. And so if we're going to be involved in the leading of people and their souls to salvation, then we need to understand the devil's arsenal. And what we're going to be talking about this week is certainly the devil's arsenal. One more motive I have this week, one measure I have this week. As I've been preparing these lessons and so forth, a friend of mine sent me this meme. Now, you may not know what the simulacrum or Plato's theory of forms or an empiricist or the will to power is, but I hope you can already see the absurdity of this meme of this girl taking a picture of this material and standing in the way of the projection and therefore taking a picture of her own shadow. I do want to say there is so much rich irony in describing the elements here that I hope by the end of the week that you'll have some appreciation. My friend sent me this meme while I was with a group of guys. I chuckled, and they said, "What are you laughing at?" And I showed them, and they said, "Oh, okay." I hope we can all laugh together at the end of the week at this meme. All right. Let's talk about modernism this morning, and I hope to give you some sense of what it is. And tomorrow, let me give you a layout. We're going to talk about modernism, how it came to be, what it looks like as it's played out in our culture, in American culture, and even some ways in which the Bible corresponds to modernism, says some things that sound like modernism. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the ways that particularly Christianity has been affected by the philosophies of modernism negatively. On Wednesday, we'll talk about postmodernism, the history and so forth. And Thursday, we'll talk about how the church is affected by postmodernism. Friday, we'll spend talking about how we respond to modernism and postmodernism and how we sort of push back some of the effects of that. In our own minds and in churches. Before I get into those definitions, let me start here. When you're talking about when Carl Truman wrote his book about how we got to where we are, what he does is he starts pulling threads and says, what is this connected to? And a lot of times, what people feel like in any crisis moment, they feel like We have gone recently off the rails. Things felt normal a few years ago, and now they've gone awry. And usually what's happened is that they have reassessed what was happening a few years ago and normalized what was happening a few years ago, and now is the insane point. When in fact, a few years ago, people were saying, this is insane, and where did we go off? And they thought a few years before that was normal. And everybody believes that normalcy was just a few years ago, and now we've gotten off the rails. So, for instance, when people assess Disney movies, there was one of the recent Disney movies that came out, I can't even remember what the name of it was, but someone was telling me, oh, it's so refreshing, it doesn't have any of that woke nonsense in it. And so I went and I looked up the plot and I looked up some of the assessments of it, and I was like, okay, it's full of, It's so full of radical individualism and feminism and so forth, but at least there's no trans characters. That's what they meant, right? We're just back to good old 1990s Disney. That's what they meant. So it's still full of all the modernist assumptions. It's just not full of the craziest postmodern assumptions. Wonderful. No, it's not far enough. So you start pulling the strings and you say, and it's sort of like It's sort of like when you're tracing a cable. You ever try to find the origins of an electric cable and you're yanking it? One of the ways you do that is jiggle the cable on this end, and you got a guy over there going, oh, it's this one right here, right? Well, what happens is you're jiggling it, and the guy's on the other end, and he's looking for which one, and instead of seeing one jiggle here, he hears something over there, and he goes, wait a minute. Well, it's not where we thought, and he backs up over here, jiggle it again, and then the sound is a little, wait a minute, it's still farther back over here, and you just keep going back and back, and you're pulling at the threads, and you're trying to figure out, where's the starting point for all of this? I was having a conversation with a friend of mine, Wes Brown, who I know has read a lot more than I have, and I said, where do you start? I mean, as you're pulling threads, and you're saying, We've gotten off course, and we've gotten so far off course, and what really is the origin points of that? And he says, well, I reckon it's Genesis chapter 3. And it is, obviously, Genesis chapter 3. But in more specific fashion, what I want to do is say, you know, what are some of the specific philosophies that got us to where we are now? In its current form, I guess. What helped us arrive at the premises that allow for drag queen story hour and more social chaos that we see around us more broadly? I'm going to make the case that so much of what we're dealing with now, started in the 80s. The 80s were a wild time of social unrest and upheaval, a time of throwing off old structures of authority and a time of optimism about what could be accomplished by human ingenuity, which soon led to drastic leaps in technology that changed the way people lived and how they viewed the world. I'm, of course, talking about the 1680s. We're going to start there. And we're actually going to go a little bit back before there to talk about what landed us there. But the 1680s is when modernism as a philosophy really began to take shape. And it's a movement that emphasized reason, science, and human progress, and by contrast, challenged traditional authorities like religion and human tradition. Backing up just a little bit from the formation of modernist philosophies, I would start back with Thomas Aquinas. Have any of you heard of Thomas Aquinas? Heard of him? So what Thomas Aquinas did was sort of baptize the philosophies of Aristotle and before him Plato and a little bit of Socrates. But he took Aristotelian logic and he said, really, Aristotle was discovering truth within God's creation. And so by God's common grace, he was able to see certain truths and realities within God's creation. And so we can sort of take that Aristotelian path in order to see God and see the truth of God. And we can do that even without biblical revelation. So there are sort of two paths, and we talk about this, natural revelation and divine, you know, more direct revelation, the logos revelation. And so you've got this natural truth and you've got this revealed truth, and you don't need the revealed truth in order to see the truth of nature. And ultimately, all of this, you can even use nature to discover biblical truths. And ultimately, all of this was to show that faith and reason were compatible, that they were not competing elements, because that had begun to be an issue. But also, what it ended up doing, what Aquinas did, was disconnect these two ways of knowing, these two types of truths, that there was sort of a firm, observable reality, and then there was this spiritual reality over here, and that you could know these things firmly, but these things fell more into a different realm of knowing, a different type of truth, and maybe even truth wasn't the way to describe that at all. And he at least planted the seeds for that. Some people call this an upstairs, downstairs divide, a sort of a duality of man, the physical and the spiritual. Well, in doing this, in sort of bringing that sort of philosophical, dialogical knowledge into Christianity, what Thomas Aquinas founded was a movement known as Scholasticism. Now, Scholasticism is very similar to rabbinical teaching. So like the Talmud and so forth, where there's just these long dissertations thinking well past whatever the scriptures say, right? So you got what the scriptures say, and well, what would that mean about this? And then what would that lead to about this? And so by the time Jesus comes, it's so refreshing to hear someone teach who just kind of wipes all that away and gets to the point, right? And I think that's a lot of what people mean. Here is a man who teaches with authority. Instead of saying, well, the so-and-so says, and the so-and-so says, and never coming to any conclusions, you have this scholasticism. Now, scholasticism is not just nonsense. It is nonsense, but we can at least appreciate the motives of what's happening there. They are trying to answer what I believe are important questions, but it just leads down paths of absurdity very often. How many of you ever heard the question, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? You heard that that was a question. Okay. There is no recorded case of this question actually being asked. It's actually a mockery of the types of questions that they were asking. But the reason that they were asking a question that does sound like that is what they were pondering is, do angels actually take up space in physical reality? Or is their spiritual beingness disconnected from physical, like tangible reality, so that angels could inhabit the same space at the same time? Now, do you think that's an important question? Okay. At one level, you might think, why even ponder a question like that? Because what they were wondering is, what about our resurrected bodies? Do we still take up space and time in the resurrection? Now, is that an important question? Well, we're getting closer, right? They're asking metaphysical questions about the realities, about spiritual realities, and what's true and false about that, and trying to come to some conclusions. Now, I think part of the problem is they're trying to come to conclusions that God's word will not get you to, that God's revelation will not get you to. And so that does lead you to a place of absurd speculation. I think that they got so lost in these questions that they ended up with layers and layers of commentary that would allow, on technical grounds, so many of the abuses of the Catholic Church. When you read of the abuses of the Catholic Church, you're like, how could anybody think that some of those things that they were doing was okay? It is the same way the Jewish leaders thought what they were doing was okay. It's through layers and layers of commentary that they've arrived at sort of these technical ways of justifying what they were doing. And you're like, okay, I mean, I guess if you go from here to here to here to here, then somehow this ends up sounding okay. And it is really rooted. It starts with some legitimate consideration or thought process. Well, all of that led to the ideas of the Reformation. And those ideas really began before the Reformation started. Erasmus was asking some of those same questions and saying, all of this is crazy. And it led to one of the clarion calls of the Reformation, which is sola scriptura, right? Just back to the scriptures. Let's wipe away all of this layers of commentary and let's just use God's word. Are we all on board with that? Yes. Okay. Okay, good. Yeah. So that's our thought process, right? We only want to use the scripture. Well, while they were making that appeal, they were willing to follow that appeal in various degrees of extremity. Erasmus is saying all of those things, but saying we don't need to do anything to the structures of the Catholic Church, right? There's no need to leave the Catholic Church. Luther is not so far, though he and Erasmus get pitted against each other. He's really not that far from Erasmus. He is willing to leave the church, but really thinks that the structure of the church is mostly okay. And a lot of the traditions of the church, they're okay. It's just really the sort of the corruption and so forth that needs to be rooted out. And then you have all the way from there to Zwingli and Anabaptists who are just burn it all to the ground and start over, right? And everything in between. But the problem is this. Here is what people said. If we would just go back to the Bible, then we can do away with all of this infighting and we can just say the Bible's going to be our source, we're just going to do that, and we can all agree about what that says, and that way we're not relying on all these opinions that have developed over the years. And as we know, that's exactly what happened. It's not exactly what happened. They did succeed in crushing the iron grip authority of the Catholic Church the world over. But they then reasserted in their own localities their own iron grips of authority. And they did violently suppress each other in their various perceived heresies, and certainly did not arrive at some utopic moment of everybody being on the same page and following the same interpretations of Scripture. So out of all of that infighting came a desire to find something we could all agree on. We obviously can't all agree on the Bible. We've tried that now, and that didn't work. So what can we all agree on? It created a lot of skepticism, right? You had sort of this overarching authority where people just lived their lives under the interpretations that were handed down to them. Now all of a sudden they got the Bible for themselves and they think this is going to lead to unity, and then it doesn't. And apparently we can't all see the Bible the same. Maybe the Bible's not even true. There's all sorts of skepticism about that, about who God is and so forth. And enter into that René Descartes. Who knows who René Descartes is? Who has heard, "I think, therefore I am"? Okay, now you know who René Descartes is. That's really all you need to know. That is the keystone of his philosophy. I think, therefore I am. Now, what that means, what he's saying is, all right, we can start doubting. We can doubt the Bible. We can doubt God. We can doubt everything. But the fact that I am saying I doubt means I exist, right? There is no one to doubt if I don't exist. So my doubt is the foundations of my knowledge for my own existence. Now, does that sound rational to you? All right. It can sound rational, but what it has done is taken away the foundations of your knowledge of your existence from God and shifted it to your own mind. You become the foundation of really all knowledge. It starts right here. I know I exist, and from that I can build out this case. Later, postmodernists will come along and they will shatter that. And it's not hard to shatter. You cannot build the foundations of the world from what's inside your head. You can only do it from what's inside God's mind. And so he thinks that he's made a more stable foundation, but really, Descartes is not arguing against, he's actually trying to argue for the existence of God. But what he's saying is, how do we get there, not from revelation, but by instinct, from our own minds? How do we arrive at a knowledge of God? And I want to caution you, because I think in our efforts of apologetics, we've accepted some of the assumptions that say we don't need the Bible to prove God's existence. We can use our own reason to prove God's existence. So what we've done is we've accepted the modernist premise, We've stepped over into their world and then say, I'm going to bow to you on your terms. Well, you've already handed over the game. You've already said, I'll play by your rules. And if you say, like the Bible, that in the beginning God, they will say, hey, that's a presupposition. And I, in contrast to Descartes, would say, that's right, because if we don't start there, then we're not breathing right now. We don't have anything without a presupposition of God. It is okay to have, everybody has presuppositions. Mine allows me to have ground to walk on. What do yours do? Right? Somebody says, let's talk about God, but let's assume nothing. You can't do that. You have to assume God from the get-go. And the Bible does not spend time saying, let me rationalize you to God. It just says, let me tell you who he is. All right. Now, we could talk more about presuppositionalism at another time if you'd like. Then comes along Thomas Hobbes. And I'm way oversimplifying all of this. Let me just say, I understand that. I'm picking out some names that I hope you will recognize in the deep recesses of your mind from high school history, and showing how they are particularly important in this movement. So Thomas Hobbes, he views humans as, he's sort of a deist and believes humans are mere outcomes of material processes, and that they would always act in self-interest, which he describes as a solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short life. And therefore, they need a strong government to practice restraint on those tendencies. So he writes this book, The Leviathan. You need a strong government to restrain the brutishness of people. Well, so that's Hobbes' view of humanity. Locke comes along, John Locke, and he claims empiricism is how to discover all truth. So this is this idea, going back to Descartes, of how do we find something we can all agree on? Well, we can all agree on facts. This is the roots of just the facts philosophy. Anything outside of what can be empirically shown, observed, etc., should be considered personal liberty, and government should be limited only to what can be empirically proved, empirically provable, tangible things. And so Locke, again, is not an atheist. He believes in God, but he believes that the only things we can agree on about God are those tangible, empirical, you know, physical things. It's a very materialist view that he has. One more element I'll throw in here already. This is basically a lot of your foundations of the American Revolution, and we'll add a little bit to that as we go along. Isaac Newton comes in and I think adds one more additional element, and there are other thinkers like Leibniz who some would claim discovered these things before Newton. But Isaac Newton comes along, and you know what he's famous for, right? For getting hit in the head with an apple. He is famous for describing nature in mathematical terms. He puts formula to gravity. People knew about gravity, but they couldn't mathematically describe gravity. And Newton comes along and gives more precision to our knowledge of the world. Now, Newton himself is, again, a theologian. He writes more theology than he does mathematical treatises. And in fact, a lot of it is worth reading. He is a fascinating character. But what he also does is lays the groundwork to suggest you don't need God in order to understand nature. Now, Newton doesn't say that, but he does plant that seed. Because you could just observe. Do you need to believe in God to discover that 2 + 2 = 4? What would you say? No. But I want to suggest to you before we're done that I will show if you want to keep 2 + 2 = 4, you better believe in God. Because you will lose it, as we are presently in our society. All right. So this is empirical path of modernism, right? This is how we know things. These are the actual things that can be known. And then we're going to separate that from other categories, values over here, fact, value, distinction, and so forth. And this is the foundations on which the American government is placed. Well, another path in modernism is happening simultaneously and in some ways challenges this path of modernism. And that all starts with Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Have you heard of Rousseau? Okay. Incidentally, have y'all heard of the Democracy in America that was written by... Tocqueville. I always call him de Tocqueville, but Alexis de Tocqueville. You don't know who Alexis de Tocqueville is? So he was a guy that came into America early days, early 1800s, and he observed from a European standpoint democracy in America and made observations. And really, overall, he loves America, right? I mean, he thinks it's incredible. But one of the things that he says is basically they are rooted in these philosophers, but they don't even know who these philosophers are. It is more true than it has ever been. That we are rooted in old philosophers that we don't even know the names of. And so when somebody says, why should I study this guy? Because you think like this guy and you don't know it. And that's the problem. And so Rousseau comes along he emulates or provides the very model of reprobate philosophers that will come after him. Most of the philosophers that we will talk about from this point on are absolute derelicts in all of their responsibility. They are profligate in their living. They are debauched, and they want to tell us all how to live. I think that would classify most philosophers, especially, as I say, from this point on. Well, Rousseau comes along, and what he says is that the problem with people is society and private property and rule of law. And if we would just be left alone, that we are all actually born innately and inherently good, and that it is society that corrupts us. And so what we need to do is peel back all of this regulation of society, and people are best in the state of nature. Have you heard the term tabula rasa? So tabula rasa is the blank slate. Everybody comes in with basically no programming, and it's society that gives it bad programming. And so the best we could do is be the noble savage. Have you heard that terminology, the noble savage? All right, so the noble savage describes, especially because during this time, the American territory is being discovered, and the Indian cultures that have been cut off from civilization are being cultured. And isn't that the perfect society? If you believe that the Indians were virtuous and noble and dignified before the Europeans got there and corrupted them all, then you have been fed a big old pack of lies. They were bloodthirsty pagans who sacrificed each other to their sun gods, ate each other's hearts in order to gain strength, and had developed ways of torture that rival some of the most brutal regimes that the world has ever known. Now, I am not excusing the Europeans in any of the atrocities they committed, but they did not come into an idyllic land of Eden populated by, untouched and untainted territory. Any group of people who denies the one true God will devolve into chaos. Now, but Robespierre says, people are good. And what we need is to get rid of all the oppressive authorities. And the way to do that, Rousseau, we'll get to Robespierre in a moment. Rousseau says the way to get to that is to take away all these forms of government so that people can rule themselves. What we need is total democracy. And if you give the run of it all to the people at large, then we will end up at a better place. Robespierre, Maximilian Robespierre came along and he says, that's right. And let's do it. And so he is part of the lead of the French Revolution, which takes, instead of taking Locke and Hobbes especially, he takes this contrasting view, not that people are brutish, but that people are actually good. And what we need to do is throw off the authorities, cut off their heads, and the people will rise up into a utopia. And he and all of the people around him were consumed by their own movement. He said, you need to get rid of the authority structure. They did, and then they turned to him and said, now you're the authority structure. And they kept taking off heads until there were not many heads left to take off. And so the French Revolution went up in, was washed away in a river of blood and flames. But the ideas weren't. And while the French Revolution failed to accomplish what it said it was going to accomplish in France, it did plant seeds that continue to be a part of our breathing today. We still think very often that government is the problem. Government's not the problem. And in fact, what we will find is that modernism says if we could just get the right government in place, the problem is always the people who are being governed. You can have a democracy. You can have a monarchy. What will determine whether that is a good government is whether it is governing a good people. When you have a people who are bloodthirsty and wicked, they will turn whatever form of government it is into tyranny, because sin and wickedness always calls tyranny down on itself. So, don't buy into the modernist conceit that democracy is the way to hope. No. Righteousness is the way to hope. So, coming back then, Immanuel Kant is a philosopher that comes along. And he is an existentialist and a transcendentalist. I can't think of the guy's name at the moment. Another guy that's a transcendentalist that is a little bit more religious than Kant. But Kant comes along and he, Kierkegaard, yeah, Soren Kierkegaard. I love to hate him. But Kant's far worse. Kant comes along and he says that everything we view through a lens of our own experiences, which is true to a degree. And so he's saying that we can't ever truly perceive reality, but what we can do is we can compare our perceptions and what we can universalize, we can establish that as morality, that as ethics. So essentially, you just need to ask yourself, if you're going to do something, would I be all right if everybody did that same thing? And that will tell you whether or not that's a moral thing. Now, there's nothing wrong with that as a consideration of morality, but it is not the only consideration of morality. In fact, there are things that are right for one man to do and not right for another man to do. There are rights and responsibilities that differ from one person to another. And so not all ethics can be universalized in the way that Kant thought it was. But the key element there is that Kant thought, ultimately, we can rationalize, reason our way to ethics and morality. We don't need, and Kant wasn't just totally throwing out the scriptures, but what he was saying is we don't have to have that. We can all come to agreements about what's right and wrong, even if we don't have the Bible. Now, I want to suggest to you, that is a very pervasive idea, even among Christians, that we don't actually have to. I talk to people about abortion sometimes, and they'll say, how do you argue against abortion, but don't use the scriptures? And my answer is always, why do I need to throw away the best arguments? Why would you start there? Because what you're doing is you're already conceding something that you should not. Because the best argument against abortion is that every one of those babies is made in the image of God. And you will not find a better argument than that. So don't throw that away. Well, Darwin comes into the game and he really escalates everything. Because what happens up to Darwin is people, if you've noticed a trend, people are trying to find ways to exclude God from the conversation. We don't have to have God. And it's not just coming from people who don't believe in God. It's coming from people who do believe in God but want to be able to agree with people who don't. And so how do we set God to the side but still come to terms of agreement? And they're able to explain away God from the need to have God in our agreement about nature. And they're able to take God away and say we don't need God to agree about government structure. And we don't need God in order to agree about morality and ethics even. But the one thing that remained is how do we explain where it all came from? Darwin comes in and says, I got an idea. And in fact, it was his grandfather who had an idea. His grandfather is actually the one who posited the idea of evolution with zero evidence, but lots of motivation. And here's what I want to make sure you know about the theory of evolution. If you know nothing else about it, do not ever buy into the idea that Darwin simply observed nature and was drawn to the conclusion of evolution. Darwin observed a need to get rid of God, came up with an explanation, and backfilled with what he saw in nature and said, here's a way that might prove my theory. And all of it was predicated on ignorance of what was actually in nature. If Darwin knew, had known what was in a single cell, his whole theory falls apart. But what he does is allows people to believe in this narrative of man progressing and getting better and better all the time. Karl Marx comes along. He takes the theories, especially of Rousseau and Robespierre, there's pretty much a straight line from the French Revolution to Marxist revolutions. He divides the world into, he says, society has arbitrarily instituted structures of power and class and has divided us into classes, but the ultimate goal of society and the arc, the moral arc of history is moving towards equality and justice for everyone. And the modernist aspect of that is that there's a belief that humans are moving towards this grand existence, this utopic existence, this perfectibility of man. And if they did not hurry up, he would like to see people help it along, which is always the case with the saviors that come along. Sigmund Freud then comes in a lot later, as a modernist. And what he does is he modernizes our view of the human mind. The human mind was viewed in spiritual terms, that it is deeply connected to our spirit, to our souls. It is our identity, that God, it's that God-given identity. Freud comes along and says, no, it is simply another organ in your body. And it acts in the ways that it has been conditioned to act. And so he makes a mechanical view of the mind. And he establishes a whole movement that says we need to look at the mind in terms of the environment, the immediate environment around it, motivations and so forth, and basically come to conclusions about why we're acting the way we are because of all the influences on us. And that will explain everything. And we can ultimately always explain everything in those certain terms. Here's what I want to say. modern psychology does not still use all of the framework of Freud. It's thrown out especially his sexual interpretations of motivation. So what Freud said ultimately is that everybody wants to sleep with their mother and kill their father. And that is not an exaggeration. That is literally his premise. Everybody wants to sleep with their mother and everybody wants to kill their father. And what they're doing in life is ways of playing out those two fundamental drives. Now, that's nonsense. And even the world has come to understand that's nonsense. But they have never left the premise that your mind is a mere organic piece of meat operating in mechanical ways, in chemical ways that have nothing to do with spiritual realities. And so we need to be careful that we don't give ourselves over to people who start with that premise. All right, here's some core tenets then of modernism. Universal truth, there's universal truth versus subjective values. Now, we believe in universal truth, but what modernism did was subject that which is not strictly observable to a private realm of subjective interpretation. So I hear this all the time, that the existence of God, that is not something that we can have, that we can base any public policy off, because that is ultimately a private value, the existence of God. We can't have discussion. We can't prove it. We can't touch him. We can't, you know, put him under a microscope, and therefore, that will always belong in the private realm. I want to tell you that God's word says everything starts with and is built on God, the fear of God. And so we can't concede this. We can't put things over into the subjective that ought to belong in the area of fact. They really leaned into math, and if it could not be put into a mathematical formula, then it isn't really a fact. Again, you don't need God to know that 2 + 2 = 4, and it creates this fact-value distinctions. We can debate facts because they're observable. And they're subject to empirical testing, but we can't debate values. I believe we can debate values, and I believe we can use the revelation of God to arrive at truth about values. Well, also infinite progress versus cycles of rising and falling. That is, man is always getting better and better. Everything is always improving. Evolution certainly plays into this, but there's just a progress that every generation is adding knowledge, and we're getting wiser and wiser. The other day, I saw a TikTok video where a girl was decrying that we would still be constraining ourselves to a constitution written by men who were so stupid that they thought bleeding people was a good medical practice. And I thought I would take one sentence from one of those men, and I don't think they're the greatest men of all time, but I think you would be able to find more wisdom in one sentence written by one of those men than a whole day's worth of TikTok videos from her or anybody else. But she looks back and thinks, because she has access to all of this knowledge, that she is actually a master of it. But she actually knows none of it. She doesn't even know what those men thought. And so we have an illusion that we're getting wiser and wiser, and it has led to what G.K. Chesterton called chronological snobbery. It also has led to a belief that even the unanswered questions, they'll be solved eventually. We just need more time. This is, incidentally, what, you know, some people will say when we say, I can't answer that question, that is something that God knows and I do not. Well, that's a God of the gaps, right? You just put God in when you don't know the answer. Guess what they do? Progress is their God of the gaps. It is the atheism of the gaps. We'll know one day. And guess what? There's things they've been saying that about for, you know, about 1,000 years now. And we still don't know those answers. There's a radical rejection of tradition versus a deference to the past. Now, obviously, we'll talk about the need to challenge tradition, but we don't need to ignore tradition. We need to acknowledge it and acknowledge it as collected wisdom of the ages. Here it is assumed that if it is back in the past, then obviously we've learned better and we don't even need to study that. And it has led to a greater and greater rejection of those things. It also believes in grand narratives, and in this case, discovered grand narratives as opposed to revealed grand narratives. Grand narratives are like evolution, right? Evolution is a grand narrative. Life started here and is progressing. Survival of the fittest is a grand narrative. Another grand narrative would be Marxism, right? That society is always pressing towards equality and the tearing down of the powerful and so forth. So these are grand narratives. I believe in a grand narrative, but I believe it's the one that the Bible gives us. And so that's what they were rejecting. It's not the grand narrative that's been handed to us. It's the one that we observe. And everybody then comes up with their alternatives of looking at society and explaining history. And each one is as certain about their hypothesis as the next. These are some of the core tenets of modernism. Modernism in America. How does this play out? Well, from the very beginning, America was a new form of government. What Americans believed was that they were going to observe all the mistakes of all the governments of history and fix them. And we were going to have a government that actually avoided every pitfall that every government has ever made and establish a government that would finally arrive at the way to govern the people. And obviously, there's been no mistakes. Manifest destiny is another aspect. This idea that it is just, this is, again, the moral arc of history. That a lot of people think that manifest destiny is rooted in the belief that God was on America's side. And there are certainly people who posited that and believe that. But the reason they believe that is because they thought America had arrived. And it was a modernist assumption that says, we have arrived at this great place, and the sooner everybody else gets on board, the better. And so we will exert our influence in all of these different directions. It certainly has guided education. Education becomes about exploring of the new and throwing off the restraints of tradition. Education used to be about making a virtuous people. That's what it was, to make men virtuous. Now, that's all off the table, and it's simply to make men be able to be explorers, to be thinkers, to be able to find new things. Horace Mann, who's considered the father of modern education, if you think that public education is the way, I would implore you to go read The People at the Very Foundations of Public Education. It is horrifying, right? At the root, they are trying to accomplish things that Christians do not want to accomplish. Horace Mann said, "Let the mind be enlightened by knowledge, and the moral sentiments will take care of themselves." Hogwash. What you are doing is creating a people that think if they know the facts, they know all they need to know. And they can be the arbiters of right and wrong because they are the knowers of the facts. We are being led by a cadre of people who think that sort of thing. Morals will come from knowledge and not the other way around. Morals only constrain people so they can't do the actual exploring, right? And then what's the culmination of that? Well, the culmination of that, I want to tell you, is Nazi scientists who are not restrained by morals, and they are able to truly explore pain in people and the human body and how it works and use live people for their experiments because they're not constrained by morals. That is a goal of public education. Now, I know what you might be saying, well, that's not the public education I grew up with. Yes. Because everybody doesn't go in all the extreme directions. But I'm telling you, the men who developed it thought those things. Finally, the primacy of science. The all-encompassing belief in the certainty of scientific discovery. One of the things I hear constantly about this is, you know, science is great because if we discover a mistake, well, we change our assessment and we move forward. Yeah, that happened really well in 2020. Every time different information came to the table, people were very humble and honest about their assessments and just, right? No. Double down, double down, double down. That's what people do. They don't want to be humiliated. And without the guidance of virtue, they have no motives to be humble. They have every motive to be haughty and to double down. History does not bear out that they changed their assessments. In fact, not only do they not do that, but what about the millions who constantly die because of their mistakes? Well, we just got that one wrong. Yeah. And you had a whole host of people, maybe millions, who died because you made a mistake. So we need to be careful about our over-reliance on science. Well, I hope that you're already seeing some cracks in the facade, but I do want to suggest this before we leave off. There are premises of modernism, and this is why it's difficult, that the Bible supports. We do live in an orderly universe. God is a God of order. He brings order from chaos. This is what Newton was basing his whole theory on, is that we live in an ordered world, and therefore I can discover things and I can know that those will be constants because we do not live in a chaotic. The Greeks actually thought we did live in a chaotic world because their view of creation was chaotic. But our view is that God brought order from chaos. And so as we read in Genesis chapter 1, or as we read in Psalm 19 in the proclamation of God's glory, as we read in Romans chapter 1 in verse 20, what we can know about God, His invisible attributes are made known by what is seen. And so I believe in that, but we need to be careful that we don't come to the conclusion, therefore, that the universe tells us everything about God. It begins to tell us about God. Belief in human advancement. God says He created man in His own image to exercise dominion. And then in chapter 2, He tells man to cultivate the garden. Don't just go and maintain it, cultivate it. That is, improve what you've been given. We continue on to read in Genesis and we see, here's one who came and he made musical instruments. Here's one who came and he made tools of iron, right? There is that expectation of improvement. Job chapter 28 is beautiful in this. He lays out what all man's able to accomplish, how deep he's able to burrow into the earth and find all these things. Incidentally, in verse 12, though, he says, but where can he find wisdom? It is not that we don't believe in human advancement, but we believe in the limitations of it, that we recognize it can only ever get us so far. AI will not get us to wisdom. It will do no more than the things Job describes in Genesis and in Job 28, 1 through 11. And then there's rejection of tradition, which again, we recognize that there's a need to challenge what has been received and not just blindly accept what has been handed down from our forefathers, the traditional assumptions. Because in Mark chapter 7, you have the teachers, the Jewish leaders, who assume things and then assume that what they have developed over traditions is now the truth, and Jesus comes. Jesus is a subversive teacher. That's true. Galatians chapter 3 and verse 28, we talked about this morning, all these assumptions about what the Bible meant. Paul comes in and he interprets that in a way that challenges those things. That's true. But we challenge authority with Scripture, not with our own intuition, not with our own latest wisdom. And finally, grand narratives. As I said before, we do believe in a grand narrative. We believe in a narrative that started at the beginning of the world. And we believe that that narrative continues to this day. And it continues to help us interpret what is happening in the world. I believe you can still interpret history through the Scripture. that we can see what's happening. Revelation is an eye-opener. When you see what's happening and you see it happens again and again and again. And I don't just mean by that that it's only cyclical, but I do mean that God shows you what's happening in the world and he gives you the ways of interpreting that. And it is a narrative and he is at the head of that narrative. So that's some support for modernism. Tomorrow, again, we'll be focused on pointing out the issues, how it's infiltrated spiritual conversations and thought processes. Thank you so much for your attention.
Thanks. Presentation.
Appreciate it.
Hey. Do you have any reading recommendations on this?
Yeah, lots.
Yeah. I don't know if you just want to write it down there or just.
Yeah. So I would say, How Shall We Then Live by Francis Schaeffer is critical. And The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self by Carl Truman. Both of those are probably good primers to get started.
Okay. The Rise and Triumph is really good for summarizing like the
progression.
Kind of like you did in this. It's like a little bit more detailed what Stephen just did of detailing the...
How Shall We Then Live by who?
Francis Schaeffer. Yeah, so this is more focused on where we are now. Of course, this Schaeffer's writing, I think, in the early 80s. He's writing this, so he only takes you there. Carl Truman,
1680s?
No, yeah, right. Carl Truman sort of backs up and then picks up where he leaves off and gets us all the way to now, right? So those in tandem are very helpful.
You study much? That was great.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Look forward to this. Strange New World. But the realistic part is once you leave the Bible,
it's kind of like... Yeah.